Welcome to the ACUFP Resident Podcast. This is going to be part of an ongoing series of podcasts hosted by the members of ACUFP Resident Council. Hello, everyone. Welcome to our first ACUFP Resident Podcast, where we pad our degree with the OFP.
Oh, boy.
All right, so I'm Elaine Ho, and here with us are
Annie Hutchinson
and Carrie Beth Watts.
So our first topic is the bread and butter of family medicine, lifestyle management for people with diabetes, what you need to know from the ADA standards of care by Drs. Kim Fotenhauer, Joy Dugan, Sarah Bradley, Jay Shubrook, and Andrew Reinhardt. From Toh University, by the way, my alma mater. Woot!
So we see diabetes every single day in our clinics and in the hospitals. It's obviously very easy to tell our patients to go home and just live a diabetic lifestyle, but it's often hard to translate exactly what that means for them. So the article is based actually on the new ADA standards, and it highlights the most important lifestyle recommendations, so high yield, and these recommendations can help our patients achieve good outcomes with regards to their diabetes.
So let's start with physical activity. The ADA recommends people with diabetes to participate in four types of exercise: aerobic, resistance, flexibility, and balance exercises.
All right, so let's start with aerobic exercise. These exercises help lower A1C, blood pressure, insulin resistance, and lipid profiles. They include things like cycling, swimming, walking, basically any type of exercise that involves continuous movement of large muscle groups. So no, continuously using your finger muscles for League of Legends does not count. Do you guys know this reference, by the way?
I do not.
Okay.
But I imagine it's a game.
Yes, it is. Yeah, my brother plays it all the time. Yeah.
Gamers, that doesn't count. Next up in terms of exercises is flexibility exercises, which overall, you know, next to balance exercise, is probably one of the easiest that most patients, including our elderly populations, can do at home. No supervision. You can demonstrate it in the office. They can repeat it themselves, show you they learned what they're doing. It's basically just stretching, and the goal is to increase your range of motion on joints that can help with your balance. And then you can repeat these about 2 to 3 times a week and then work up to about once daily.
Resistance training. So this is important for diabetics because just having diabetes is a risk factor for decreased muscle mass and decreased strength. These exercises help increase your strength, your bone mineral density, and can improve A1C by as much as 0.5%, which I think is pretty impressive. It also decreases exercise-induced hypoglycemia that can be associated more with the type 1 diabetics. So these exercises would include, you know, weighted exercises, arm raises, leg raises, planks, wall squats, all that good stuff that you can give counseling and demonstrate for them right there in the office. Just like the flexibility exercises, at least 2 to 3 sessions per week would be important and on non-consecutive days. So maybe alternating these days with their aerobic activity.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And the last one to talk about is balance exercises. Of course, with diabetes, we can't forget about peripheral neuropathy and the fall risk that comes with that. So it's important to train how to walk with the neuropathy. Activities like yoga and tai chi are mentioned in the article, which are excellent exercises that train balance. And it also trains you in flexibility and resistance, too. So it does add those different components in those exercises as well.
Can I tell a quick story here, too, about balance exercises? I was at a concert the other night, and one of the ushers in the auditorium, senior citizen, and he would do tai chi on the side, like, during the show.
Oh,
and I thought that was awesome. So clever of him. Like,
hey,
it was quiet,
yeah.
And he would just, and I'm like, this is his routine. Like, this is what he does, his balance and flexibility. And I thought that was a pretty cool way he incorporated it into his day.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah, that is exciting. I don't know about you, but hearing that story, he makes me feel bad about myself because I haven't left my desk for several days now. I'm always sitting down. I definitely don't take the time to exercise. So counseling my patients about it is kind of tricky at times because it makes me feel a little bit guilty. So how would you recommend that we start?
So it can sound overwhelming for sure, but I think that the most important thing to do is try to reduce sedentary behavior any way you can. I always tell my patients, pick one thing that you can do better tomorrow. What's one way that you can sit less in your day? So walking 15 minutes around the block, around the house after you eat can improve your glycemic control. The article itself recommends like 25 minutes of activity per day. And when you think about, you know, helping the patients list all the things that they need to do in their day, you can probably clock up some minutes pretty quickly.
Yeah. So like, for example, maybe they can do 10 minutes of 10 minutes of exercise in the morning and, you know, squats while brushing your teeth, and a couple minutes of jogging to and from the car if you can park your car a bit far away from work, and making sure to take stairs at work. Maybe, you know, fit in a Tai Chi form sometime in your day, like before lunch, and then that short walk after dinner, and then voila, you have your 25 minutes accumulated over the day.
For younger patients with type 2 diabetes, the research is still inconclusive, but the ADA suggests at least an hour a day for at least 3 days a week. So definitely challenging that population that tends to be younger, healthier, and can handle more exercise.
Yeah, I like all those ideas. That kind of breaks it down, doesn't make it seem so overwhelming. And I think patients can probably relate to that broken down method where fitting it in as opposed to this massive change that they're going to mm-hmm. be expected to make or that we're demanding of them.
Definitely.
So is there anything specific about type 1 diabetics? We haven't really talked about them too much yet.
Yeah, so things to keep in mind for the type 1 diabetics. Prolonged exercises can lead to hypoglycemia. Like we talked about earlier, you know, the resistance training maybe being a little bit more safe for them. So if it lasts longer than 30 minutes, then they're going to really need to be cautious. As always, monitoring their glucose with frequent checks before, during, and after exercise. And then adjusting their carb intake and their insulin dosage. The pre-exercise blood glucose range ideally should be between 90 and 250. So this can obviously vary widely between patients, but just working closely with them and what you know about their history to kind of make an ideal plan.
Yeah, and the article mentioned that suggesting mixed activities like interval training or field sports where they're not going for long periods of time without stopping helps with glucose stability.
Okay, gotcha. Good tips. Now, I've also heard about and don't know as much about the concept of exercise-induced nocturnal hypoglycemia. The bigger risk I worry about is that the hypoglycemia can occur up to 48 hours after exercise, which a lot of people aren't aware of. Yeah. So how would you go about preventing that?
Yeah, that is kind of scary to think about. So to prevent this, for those on multiple daily dosed insulin injections, you'll need to reduce your basal insulin and prandial boluses by about 20%. Also have a low glycemic index snack immediately after the exercise.
Mm-hmm. And for insulin pump users, you can reduce the setting for the basal rate by 20% at bedtime for 6 hours after they exercise. Make sure they have a bedtime snack too, or even setting up glucose alarms at night.
Okay. So really just paying very fine attention to the details and frequent checks and counseling that and kind of making them aware might help them through that. There's another concept, exercise-induced hyperglycemia, that I've heard about. So for type 1 diabetics, it might be like the body's defense against that hypoglycemia that we just talked about. And type 2 diabetics can get it as well if they've overeaten carbs or if they reduce their insulin too much. So for our listeners, that's another concept that you might just want to, you know, put in the back of your mind in terms of counseling your patients.
Definitely. So what we're really talking about here is how important it is to adjust your dosing concomitantly with those changes in diet and your exercise routine.
Yes. Speaking of that, though, how do you adjust the dosage, and do you need dosage for any type of diabetic treatment?
Oh, these are such tough questions.
I know.
It's really good to review this periodically because I feel like it's always changing, and we get these questions so frequently.
Mm-hmm. So for people on insulin, decrease dosages on exercise dates.
Okay. And then for people who are taking metformin, your DPP-4 inhibitors, your GLP-1 agonists, your SGLT-2 inhibitors, and your TZDs, you do not need any dose adjustments, which is really makes it a little bit easier.
Definitely. Also, very important, kind of some basics. Keep cool during hot weather. In our diabetics, we know that they can be prone to more autonomic instability, and so the heat can affect them maybe more disproportionately than their healthier counterparts.
Yeah, that's a simple thing, but it's also can be easily forgotten in our care. So diabetics also have many comorbidities too. So how do they exercise if they have, let's say, cardiovascular disease?
So definitely working with your patient's cardiologist. A lot of our diabetics probably have one because we all know, you know, that they're more prone to vasculopathies and cardiac conditions. For a patient after a stroke or an MI, the exercise should definitely be started in kind of a stepwise fashion in a supervised setting, like a cardiac rehab program. That way they'll be starting at a low intensity and they can kind of slowly and moderately increase that intensity. So just a tip for reference, for low to moderate exercise, go at a rate where you feel like you're working but still able to hold the conversation well. So a great example is if you're walking with a friend and you can still visit comfortably without having to pause for breath or go long periods without talking. And then of course, for our cardiac patients, stop immediately if any symptoms of MI or stroke arise, right? Like chest pain or pressure, extremity weakness, you know, aphasia, all that kind of scary red flag stuff.
Yeah, and before we step away from that topic, the cardiac rehab, I actually have a patient who expressed a lot of concern over my suggestion for them to follow up there. They thought, you know, I was implying they were doing really poorly and that they got really concerned with that. And so the way I just described it was that it's basically just a safe space to have good exercise quality. Mm. So you've got your nurses, you have trained, you know, healthcare providers who are there supervising them, making sure they're safe, making sure that they're doing okay with the exercises that we're having them do. So patients can get scared by the term cardiac rehab, but really it's just a great place to have supervised exercise. So reassure them that it's in their best interest and that it doesn't mean you think they're doing badly.
Yeah.
You just
want
to keep them safe. The other category, or next category, I should say, is patients with peripheral artery disease can benefit from lower extremity resistance training, which is easy to do at home. And another one would be walking, which is simple and always appropriate.
Yeah. And how about patients with diabetic retinopathy? Anything we need to look out for?
Definitely sticking with that low to moderate exercise threshold, that exercising while still being able to talk. It'll be important to work with their ophthalmologist or at least be communicating regularly by sending each other charts and watching out for kind of scary complications of retinopathy like vitreous hemorrhage or retinal detachment in vigorous exercise. So it's those kind of things that we're trying to avoid with more of that low to moderate recommendation.
Mm-hmm. All right. And how about patients with peripheral neuropathy?
So this one's a tough one, and this is so common. For me and supervising patients with significant peripheral neuropathy, it all comes down to their shoes and their footwear, and it's all about protection. So we want them checking their feet before and after exercise, mainly every single day. They need to be really vigilant about that, making sure that their footwear is supportive. You can actually take the insoles out of their shoes, show them the areas of concern and breakdown that you're worried about when you have them in the office in front of you. And then if they do have sores or injuries, avoid certain weight-bearing activities. So have them demonstrate to you what promotes their pain and make sure that you're really on top of their feet checks.
Okay. Some of those balance exercises we talked about could also be done seated. I mean, if you're worried about them standing for long periods or advising against, you know, classes or things like that, there's a lot of seated ways to work on those things.
Yeah, exactly.
Nice. And any restrictions with diabetic kidney disease?
Nope.
Awesome. Go for the exercise.
Yay. All right. And how about orthopedic limitations like Charcot foot changes or osteoarthritis?
Yeah, so this one's also very common, especially osteoarthritis. So you could always consider your non-weight-bearing low-impact exercises. Again, those balance categories, the stretching category, basically any patient can do that, including the seated position, like Carrie Beth just mentioned. How about swimming? So I was a swimmer actually in college. It's a phenomenal sport to always come back to. Technically low impact because you're buoyant in the water. It takes the pressure off of your lower extremity joints. It's a great way to get your heart rate up, to stretch, and using all different muscle groups. Even walking around in the pool, wearing a supportive belt that can help you stay afloat or upright and getting your joints moving would be a great thing. So swimming is absolutely wonderful to consider for these patients.
Awesome. Okay. I think we've had enough of exercising. How about the food?
This is the hardest part. Forget the exercise. It's the diet. So some of the diets that the article mentioned that I certainly find, at least in my practice, and I don't know about you ladies, that I recommend the most often to my patients are not really diets in the sense of rapid weight loss, but right in terms of kind of lifestyle or kind of how to approach your relationship with your food. And that would include the Mediterranean diet, the DASH diet, which is more for like the hypertensive patients or kind of that low sodium diet, and a plant-based diet.
Yep. Now I'm hungry. So, you know, we said weight loss drastically isn't necessary in these patients. So it can be more simple than that, and it may be an easier obstacle for our patients to tackle. So statistics say just 5% reduction of your body weight can improve glycemic control and reduce your medication need. And if you set those goals with your patients early on, those are tangible things. And 5% doesn't sound like such a crazy amount. So they're, you know, going to be motivated to try to tackle that.
Yeah. Okay, so now I'll list some nutrients. Give me the quick and dirty of each of them. Now, carbs.
Oh, I'm so glad that I get to talk about carbs because we are so familiar with each other. So let them know what carbs are, right? Do you guys have where your diabetic patients are like, oh, but I don't eat that much candy, or I'm not a chocolate person?
Yeah, right.
And it's so important, right, that we talk about carbohydrates and their effect on the body, that it's not just pure sugar and sweet food. So definitely listing for them what things are included in carbohydrates, what starches are, and that starches change to sugar in their body and can, you know, be damaging to their blood vessels and their eyes and their kidneys, you know, all in the same way that sugary foods can. Be mindful of cultural context here, right? That foods that they might eat that are part of their, you know, home life, part of their routine, part of their cultural upbringing, can also contain carbs. So just be showing some awareness, maybe asking them about what they eat in their day, and then pointing out to them which of those things are considered a carbohydrate. In general, high fiber, low glycemic index is what you'd be looking for in your healthy carbs.
And I could give a personal example of when my grandparents were trying to control their diabetes. And one of the things that you don't usually list, or I haven't even heard anyone list, was fish sauce in their Vietnamese food, which uses, one of the ingredients is using a lot of sugar in addition to like salts and stuff. So that's one thing that was not thought about that we used a lot.
That's a great point.
And next one, protein.
So protein's a little bit more difficult. Carbs, we can say, okay, maybe just try to avoid them point blank and monitor for hidden sources. But protein, you know, research is inconclusive about the ideal amount you should have in your daily diet. Some research states that it can help make you feel fuller and then maybe help you maintain a lower carb intake. For those with diabetic kidney disease, however, current research reveals that 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight per day is recommended. So even in patients without diabetic kidney disease, that might be a good target amount of protein for your daily diet.
Okay, and dietary fats.
So fats, this is a great opportunity to kind of dispel, you know, maybe some misunderstandings about fats that we all probably remember, that kind of low-fat craze, especially through the 90s, and a lot of people still really kind of perseverate on that and avoid fats altogether. But we know about now, you know, kind of about the benefits of healthy fats. So back to that Mediterranean diet again, where you're getting your omega-3s from healthy fishes, nuts, seeds, legumes. Evidence does not necessarily support right now the benefits of consistent omega-3 supplementation, but it is still important to encourage getting that healthy fat from your diet.
Mm-hmm. How about sodium?
So sodium in general, lower is better. I think a target amount of 1,500 milligrams per day is a general guideline that's safe for our diabetic patients.
Okay. Vitamin B12.
So a recent report from the Diabetes Prevention Program Outcome Study states that B12 deficiency may be associated with metformin use, which was definitely something I don't think I was aware of before. So consider testing vitamin B12 on your metformin patients, especially those with anemia or that are presenting with peripheral neuropathy.
And alcohol.
One of my favorites. Just kidding. So about one drink per day for women and two drinks per men is okay, I guess. But those do have calories. So again, keep that in mind, and carbohydrate calories specifically. It's associated both with hypo and hyperglycemia as well as weight gain. So the downstream effects are not the greatest. Short-term benefit, pay for it later. Yeah. So all things in moderation.
All right, how about non-nutritive sweeteners?
The word on these is generally safe, and just like Annie said, with moderation, use it within reason.
Okay. And smoking.
Okay, this one's just obvious. Stop smoking. So another disclaimer. I mean, it's really, it is that simple. Just stop smoking. Disclaimer about e-cigarettes, which people have this assumption that they are healthier alternatives. That has never been proven. And actually, I've also read studies that suggest it actually just prolongs the habitual nature of cigarette use. And right, so it doesn't actually decrease cessation rates. So bottom line, stop smoking.
And don't freak out if patients gain weight shortly after smoking cessation. It still, of course, has long-term benefits. We're all pretty familiar with the phenomenon of patients quitting smoking and kind of replacing some of that, you know, habitual kind of oral activity with eating. And so my approach to my patients is, let's tackle one thing at a time. Let's take this step by step. So be patient with that period as they stop the smoking. And then your next step is building a long-term nutrition plan.
All right. How about patient support through all of this? Because hearing all of this, it's kind of a super long list of lifestyle changes. And diabetes distress is actually a thing. Up to 48% of patients experience being overwhelmed, as I am now, right now too, from all of these lifestyle changes. So how can we help them through this process?
So that's a great question, because I agree. That's that you get a lot of the blank stares. Like, what, doc? You expect me to do all of these things right now? And that's not necessarily the case. So one thing you can offer is creating what the article discusses as a DSME. It stands for Diabetes Self-Management Education and Support Team. So you as the physician, we are doctors, we are leaders of the healthcare team, the primary care providers. You're the team leader, and you have your patient, potentially a dietitian, a nurse, and a diabetes educator specifically to come together and form a care plan that's going to help your patient improve their lifestyle.
What an awesome, awesome system. So you would have several touch points. The first is at diagnosis, right? You're all going to get together and you're going to get some serious education. Then you'll start meeting annually for assessment of the patient's education and emotional needs to provide ongoing support as they learn to cope with their diagnosis and make those changes to their lifestyle. You'll meet again when new complicating factors come up. There's been a change in their health. There's a new physical limitation, a new disability, a change in their living situation, maybe their caregiver status or support system, or an emotional obstacle to overcome. DSME is associated with less frequent use of acute care settings and decreased hospitalizations. These patients are more likely to follow treatment recommendations and have lower Medicare claim costs, so it helps the bottom line as well.
Helps the mood. Yeah.
Great goals to have. So just to summarize all of this, according to the ADA, diabetes lifestyle management includes forming a patient care team, just like we discussed, to both motivate and support a lifestyle that includes daily 25 minutes of aerobic resistance, flexibility, and balance exercises.
And remember to adjust for glucose control during exercise.
Right, and eat a combo of the Mediterranean, DASH, and plant-based diets.
All right, very cool. I think that wraps up our first episode, guys.
Yay! Yes, ma'am. Woo!
Okay, so everyone else, thank you. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, may a white cloud forever float by your side.